When you walk into O'Brien's Wines, take confidence from the fact that every one of the wines you see on our shelves comes directly from a winemaker we know personally. We choose quality so you can choose what you like. Our exceptional wines start from less than €10. We'll see you in store or online at obrienswine.ie. O'Brien's, only good choices. Please enjoy alcohol sensibly.
Never Have I Ever with Claire Byrne, a News Talk original podcast.
Sponsored by O'Brien's Wine. Try something new.
Do you get scared?
Sometimes, yeah. 3 days of a drone is my personal limit. Children's copybooks, nappies, women's high-heeled shoes.
And how do you manage yourself and how you feel?
Riders help people have that empathy. Humans are more alike than they are different. Mm-hmm. Love is just a word until someone comes along and gives it a meaning.
Never have I ever.
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 For as long as I have worked in TV and radio, war has been a constant. I was just getting started in this job, in this role, when the 9/11 attacks happened. And then followed the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, we had the Arab Spring, Syria, Ukraine, Gaza, Sudan, Lebanon, and most recently, of course, Iran. And for years, I've sat in studios talking about wars and speaking to journalists reporting right from the middle of them. And I find it so interesting that so many of the people we have spoken to who have helped us understand the reality of war have been women. If you think about it, Orla Guerin, Lise Doucette, Kate Adey, Marie Colvin, Alex Crawford, women who choose to go towards the stories when most of us, men and women, would probably and instinctively head the other way. Now, I have dipped my toe into that world once or twice. I was in Niger when the conflict was raging there, and I do remember the checkpoints and the uncertainty and that feeling that everything could change in a moment. But then I came home, and that's the important point here. I have never chosen to make that my working life. So never have I ever been a correspondent in a war zone. But my guest today has. It's Sally Hayden. Sally, you're very welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You're just back from Lebanon and you've lived there for the last couple of years. How are things in Lebanon now?
Things are terrible. I mean, it's almost impossible to kind of describe and quantify, like 1 million people displaced in a very small country, a kind of huge swath of territory at this in the south is being occupied still by the Israeli military. Attacks are continuing. Thousands of people have been killed. The devastation is just massive.
And what is an ordinary day in Beirut right now? Like, does ordinary life continue?
I actually moved to Beirut, I should say, before there was war there. So I moved there in January 2024 and there was lower level conflict at the border, but it hadn't expanded. And we didn't necessarily expect it to expand. So I actually didn't even move there to be a journalist. I moved there because I was on a break while writing my book and I had friends there. And, you know, one had a spare room and just said, why don't you come and hang out, basically. And Beirut's a lovely city. Like, it's really like a place where many people gather. There's lots going on. So I was living there already for 9 months when the war escalated and came to Beirut as well. And that was the point when I got accredited and decided I should start reporting. And since then, like, no day has been the same. There is war generally ongoing, even including that period where there was a 15-month ceasefire. There were still near daily attacks by Israeli forces, but not inside Beirut for most of that, but in more in the south. And I think that the main thing to understand about living through a war maybe is uncertainty. Like, every day you have no idea what's going to happen. You need to keep checking news updates. There's very often an Israeli drone above, so you can hear kind of this buzzing. Where I was living, or where I, like, my apartment still is, we had to evacuate it at various points. And the way that you knew in 2024 that you had to evacuate was that you'd hear gunshots. So people would fire gunshot warnings, and then you'd check Twitter or X, as it's called now, and see if there had been an IDF, kind of these forced evacuation warnings. And in 2024, those were for specific buildings more often. And you'd kind of calculate, how far is that from where I'm living, and do I have to get out? And only one time at that point I had to leave my apartment. But what happened in the more recent kind of war or escalation, depending on how you describe it, in March 2026 was that these evacuation warnings became for much, much larger areas. And so huge areas of the city and, you know, of the country were under them. And so assessing risk, you know, became much more complicated even. So my apartment was actually inside the map that was issued by the Israeli military in March. And so I ended up staying at a friend's house for 6 weeks, I think. And like, actually, it was fine.
Sally Hayden grew up in the Dublin suburb of Clunskey. She was the kind of child who always had a book in her hand. Her dad started reading The Lord of the Rings to her when she was just 3 years old. Somewhere along the way, she became fascinated by stories from far beyond Ireland. Music was a huge part of her life too, playing with the National Youth Orchestra before eventually finding her way into journalism. There was no shortcut into the career Sally wanted. She built it from the ground up, internships, freelancing where possible, and eventually reporting from almost 40 countries, many of them war zones. Her first book won some of the biggest prizes in publishing, but her latest, This Is Also a Love Story, is a very different kind of book, one that asks how, after witnessing so much conflict and suffering, we can still recognise love, kindness and hope.
Hopefully I'm not making this about myself. I'm just trying to explain what it's like when you have these maps. Like, everybody, like hundreds of thousands of people were displaced. Everybody's making assessments, you know, will I be safe? Won't I be safe? Mm-hmm. Do I have somewhere to go?
Well, the terror of that, if you're looking at a map and vast swathes of the city that you love now, the city that is home. And I'm not making this about you, you know, and I know that you always are at pains not to make it about you. But for all of the people living there, and you are one of those people now, you're looking at this and going, this entire place, we're being told on this piece of paper or this, you know, map that I'm looking at, could be destroyed in a matter of hours.
Yeah, hours or days, or I mean, it went on for weeks or, you know, years, depending on how you quantify it. But of course, I'm so lucky, you know, I'm talking from a journalist perspective in terms of my assessments. But, you know, when you think of whole families, people with young children, people with elderly parents, you know, people with disabilities, people who don't have money, you know, their jobs, their workplaces are in these areas. You know, there's people living in tents now, people living, you know, massive extended families crammed into single apartments. It's really a devastating situation. And so since mid-April, there's been, you know, some form of a ceasefire. I mean, I use ceasefire as a very kind of, people know that there's still war ongoing, but a lot of people have been able to return to their homes, at least in Beirut's southern suburbs. There was another big evacuation warning then in June, but since then again, people have gone back. But of course, nothing is certain, and many people's homes were destroyed as well. And in the south, you know, many areas are totally inaccessible. So yeah, when you talk about like what's a regular day like, I mean, I can talk from my perspective, but also the people that I see. I mean, many, many people's lives are totally devastated. From my perspective as a journalist, you wake up, you check the news, of course, what's happening that day. Things change on a very fast basis. You could make a plan to go one place and then something else happens. You know, maybe there's an airstrike and you need to go and look at the aftermath of that. Or maybe there's a funeral, you know, which tend to take place early in the morning. We're pretty early, so you want to go to that. Yeah, you're always making assessments and figuring out what is good to cover and what do you have the capacity mm-hmm. to cover as well.
You mentioned early in the book, This Is Also a Love Story, about the constant drone noise overhead. And I'm just wondering, does that ever become normal or is it always abnormal?
Yeah, it's always abnormal. And I think I realized, me personally, everybody probably has a different kind of limit, but the longest that I could bear it was 3 days, and I started getting so irritable and just, you know, it really affects you mentally. It's like having tinnitus. But the strange thing that I realized is that a lot of like technology edits that kind of noise out. So I'll be doing Zoom calls with people and, you know, I'll have this humming like above me very loud, and I'll say, you know, sorry about the drone, and they'll say, we can't hear anything. And I find that quite strange, like, because it's hard for people to imagine, you know. But I think for me, it depends where I'm reporting, obviously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can be with people and they hear a drone and they think that's going to mean an instant attack. And other parts of the city or of the country, you'll hear the drone, but you don't feel that kind of immediate threat, which, you know, obviously it's much more terrifying for people who think that they could be targeted or think that that drone could mean an imminent attack on them.
Yeah. Photography is part of your journalism as well. And just noticing some of the pictures that you've taken in Lebanon, pictures of the rubble, it's a toy giraffe or it's a school workbook or a playing card. Why is it that your eye is drawn to those types of things?
I mean, I've reported on lots of wars before, and I wouldn't call myself a war journalist. I guess you invited me on because I've reported on wars, but it's not the only thing I report on. I just report internationally on general news stories, and that has included a lot of wars. But this is my first time, I would say, living through a war. I think in 2024, like I said, I hadn't been accredited to report in Lebanon. I wasn't planning on reporting in Lebanon. And then the war escalated. And, you know, of course, that first day, hundreds of people were killed. And there was, you know, mass Israeli bombardment across much of the country. And I decided, OK, I need to get accredited. You know, I need to report on this. And so that was what I started doing. And I started going to airstrike sites. And at this point, I don't know how many I've been to, like, you know, probably 100 or, and what I was noticing is all these items, you know, if you look from a distance, you see an airstrike site, it just looks like a big mass of gray, you know, and often it takes time to get information about who was hit, you know, who was killed and what was the building. And it's very hard to even tell from buildings, you know, what was inside. But what I started noticing very quickly is just these little items in different places. And obviously, Israel had said it's hitting Hezbollah military targets. And that was kind of repeated very widely at the beginning. And what I was seeing was all of these signs of civilian life. And so I started just taking photographs of close-ups, you know, and I had some rules. I was like, I don't touch anything, you know, I'm not moving anything in this site. I tended to go to the site quite quickly after the airstrike had happened. You know, if I had any suspicion that something hadn't originally been there, I wouldn't take a photo of it. I found all of these, you know, children's copybooks, nappies, women's high-heeled shoes, different types of clothing, the remains of a pram. People can see, you know, different foodstuffs as well, UNO cards. I've actually seen at a lot of airstrike sites. I thought it was good to just take close-ups of these items and gather them together. So I started posting them on social media. And actually in 2024, the Irish Times also ran kind of a photo series of those photos. Then I stopped doing it while there was this ceasefire. You know, attacks were continuing, but not on the same scale. And then in March, the war escalated again, as we know, after Hezbollah fired rockets towards Israeli territory, and the Israeli attacks in Lebanon increased again. And I started going again to airstrike sites. And it felt actually, I never had any plan that I'll be doing this again, but it just seemed to make sense that I just start collecting these photos again.
Because it tells the story of the humanity behind the airstrike, doesn't it?
It's like, you know, these items that you would just have in any house anywhere in the world. And I think that people see them and they kind of go, oh, that could be my house. You know, that could be, I play that game with my children, or, you know, I have a dress like that, or I have a magazine like that, or I found a Dumbo the film or the Little Mermaids in one place. I mean, I've also found a lot of family photos, but I tend not to post those because often you don't necessarily know what had happened to them. And one of them that I quote in the book, in the epilogue, is I found a photo of a couple and the words written under it was, love is just a word until someone comes along and gives it a meaning. It seemed like another way to show, just to show the human impact and the civilian impact of this war.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned at the beginning that I was in Niger when conflict happened there, and I came back, I came away from that, but you go towards this. Do you know why that is, why you have chosen this life?
I think I've reported a lot on crises, but I don't think that it's necessarily that I decided, you know, I'm going to be a, you know, adrenaline war reporter or whatever. But like when I started out working, when I just finished university, I got this grant to go to Malawi. That was my first relationship with the Irish Times. So the kind of prize was a student prize, and the prize was mentoring from the Irish Times and a grant to go to, in my case, Malawi, which if anyone doesn't know, is an African country. I went there and there was a kind of corruption scandal while I was there. And so I didn't really know what I was doing. Technically, you're meant to use these grants and like go for a week and get a nice hotel and, you know, get a produce, hire a producer from the country and, you know, do everything very professionally. And I was like, no, I'll just go rent a room in someone's house and use public transport and like hang out every day in the market with the guys who worked there. And I think I stayed more than a month anyway. I don't remember how long I stayed, but I mean, I had nothing else to do.
Were you getting the call going, it's time to come back now, you've done your week? Or did they just let you do what you were doing?
They just gave me the money and I spent it like how I, you know, spent it until it ran out, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think that has been kind of how I've worked since, in terms of just doing everything, spending as much time as you can in places, talking to as many people. And I think when you do that, you find out a lot of things that you then feel like should be reported. And I think when I was in Malawi, like I said, there was this big corruption scandal and I honestly had no idea how to report it. Like I did not know what I was doing. You know, I didn't study journalism. I was really out of my depth, but it made me realize, because I knew a lot of the people who knew a lot about what was going on, you know, because I had just spent a month hanging out and talking to everybody. And I realized the value of accurate information and the value of journalism. And also a country like Malawi, even something happens that's a national crisis, like how little international coverage there was of it. And, you know,
is that disappointing to you?
Yeah, I think I just kind of, before that, I felt like journalists were everywhere and they were always providing, there would always be information about what happened. And I think seeing that, you know, if something happens but there's nobody there to cover it, how things can just go, particularly, I mean, I guess it's different now with more social media access, but like at that time, it really felt like, you know, something can happen and people can just never know about it because there's not that international attention or coverage.
Yeah, even worse than that is something happens and it is covered and people don't care.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that we're struggling with much more now, I would say, because when I started out, I really felt like coverage is the most important thing and spending time getting information and making that public so that no one can say they don't know. I think it's been kind of a bit demoralizing more in recent years to see that people often do know, but they just don't act.
And this is something that in my early years of journalism, I always felt, if people know about this thing that is happening, something will change, you know, this will affect an outcome. And often it doesn't. And that, I feel, is a really tough lesson to learn, isn't it, in journalism?
Yeah. And I think this book that I just wrote, this is also a love story. A lot of that is me kind of coming to terms with more than a decade now in journalism and realizing that that change doesn't always come. Not that it's totally a book about me, but I think that that has been something that I've been grappling with a lot. And at the same stage, I still think making the information available is so important. But I think that more and more we now have to kind of encourage people to engage with it, which I don't totally know how to do. I don't know if you saw this latest Reuters Institute app. They come out with this study every year.
Yes, and where people are trying to avoid the news, which I struggle with that as well. I think, though, there is a responsibility when it comes to what we're doing to tell the stories in a way that are digestible, that are interesting, that are appealing, you know, for an audience. And sometimes even that can be hard to take as a journalist. You know, what's wrong with facts and what's wrong with hard facts and hard reporting? But I suppose we have to accept on some level that we have to engage.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I still truly believe in the value of journalism. Like, I think that we play a really important role in just in ascertaining facts. And I hope that, I mean, I'm not holding myself up as the model journalist, but like journalism generally, I think that there are incredible journalists who are really doing their best. I think it's important for readers maybe to understand, like, in a country like Lebanon, a lot of them are freelancers. And so they're people who don't have staff jobs and they don't necessarily have commissions, and they're often funding themselves to be able to do that reporting, which is obviously a sign of the industry being kind of in crisis. And still, I think that there's a value in that. You know, we need to have this information because when you ask me, for example, why I do what I do, I mean, I always think like I'd stop doing it if I felt like it wasn't kind of adding any value. But I'm thinking of in Beirut, there were these attacks on April 8th, which I'm sure you heard about. 100 sites were hit in 10 minutes by the Israeli military. In the aftermath of that, what the Israeli military said is that it's hitting, you know, Hezbollah-linked targets. And so in the aftermath of that, journalists went out to as many sites as they could to try and figure out what has been hit. I think I personally went to 9 sites, maybe. What I found was a pharmacy, a supermarket, a residential building, a cafe was hit on the same day. For example, in the pharmacy, I gathered CCTV footage from outside where you could see someone pushing a pram right before the airstrike hit. And that, I think, was very valuable to do because you're just kind of gathering information about the actual reality on the ground. So maybe one thing is said, but what does that actually look like inside Lebanon? And, you know, something like that, I do think that it's valuable to have journalists who can track this and can actually be there. I credit a lot of my colleagues who are a lot braver than me when you talk about bravery, particularly Lebanese colleagues who have been killed and targeted. Their kind of dedication and their bravery, it's astounding.
But it is hard to hold the attention of the world news agenda, isn't it? I mean, I remember when the war in Ukraine started and on radio programs, we were covering it every single day, you know, every move that was made. And then as these things go on, you know, the attention falls away. You know, when is Ukraine mentioned now in news bulletins? Quite rarely. And I just find with your book, you sort of bring us, you draw us back in by bringing it back to the people, you know, to the couples who have been separated because one of them is on the front line. Is that a mechanism to draw attention back to a conflict, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're talking about like what is mentioned in news bulletins, I mean, some of that is an editorial decision, right? Like, I do always feel like if you cover something, people can't be interested if it's not been covered, you know? So you have to make a decision also to put effort into covering these situations so that people can follow them. But yeah, I do think that maybe using love stories as a mechanism to get people to be interested, it's also kind of just reminding people that there are humans at the center of all these situations, which I think can sounds very basic, but it can be lost. And I feel like even with Beirut, living in Beirut, I've been interviewed by people who go, oh, but, you know, aren't people there used to war, or aren't they, you know, this is just normal for them. And I'm like, no, like war is never normal for anyone. You know, tragedy is always tragedy. And I think that partially I wanted to show people that there are humans in these situations who have agency, who are making decisions that most of us could never imagine and are sometimes making quite like noble and courageous decisions. But yeah, they're also hurting. And I didn't really want to sugarcoat the realities in the book, but I do hope that it gives people another insight into some of these crises. And you're right, like some of these crises never would make the news necessarily.
When you walk into O'Brien's Wines, take confidence from the fact that every one of the wines you see on our shelves comes directly from a winemaker we know personally. We choose quality so you can choose what you like. Our exceptional wines start from less than 10 euro. We'll see you in store or online at obrienswine.ie. O'Brien's, only good choices. Please enjoy alcohol sensibly.
Just going back to what you said about going to Malawi and not doing what was expected of you, which was staying in the hotel and deciding to rent a room. I mean, you've done a lot of that, like early in your career, couch surfing. And is it true that you minded someone's cat in the Financial Times in order to get, you know, somewhere to rest your head so that you could keep working?
Yeah, I catch it for the editor. I was interning there, but it was back in the days when they didn't pay interns, or I think they gave me £50 a week or something. And the editor, Lionel Barber, needed a cat sitter and sent around an email to all of the staff. And someone was like, Sally, you don't have anywhere to live. You should do that. So
that is such a great story.
Yeah, I think it was 2014. And yeah, I was 24. And I had this kind of strange, because he had gone away, but then he came back, and there were a few days where we ended up kind of getting a chauffeured car into the Financial Times, and he'd get two copies delivered. So we'd sit in the back boat reading our Financial Times, and then I'd go off to my intern position and he'd go to be the editor. And he's a lovely person, and his wife also was so lovely. But yeah, it was quite a strange setup.
What a fabulous experience. I mean, you know, were you thinking to yourself, is this what journalism is like once you're in it for a while?
No, I was still quite stressed at the time because I didn't have anywhere to live. After I moved in with a friend, and I was just sleeping on a yoga mat, and we didn't have any hot water. I think a lot of journalists, you know, people getting into journalism in London, a lot of people are kind of, you know, you just take whatever opportunities you get in the early years, but it can be a bit of a struggle.
Do you like cats?
Yeah, I like cats.
That's good. That was good. You realise very early that enthusiasm isn't enough, that you had to learn your craft. And you made reference to this when you're talking about Malawi as well. What were the big lessons that you picked up in those early years of your career when you were with the Financial Times, CNN, with Vice, for example, which is more of an unorthodox type of setting?
I did think the Financial Times, my main job was fact-checking, and that actually, honestly, if anyone's getting into journalism, I'd really advise that you spend a bit of time doing that, because you realise that a lot of journalists make mistakes, and just how to work with people, because, you know, sometimes you'll say to journalists, you made a mistake, like, I think it's this, like, I was working on the magazine, and they'd be really, like, quite angry about it, and other times they'd be like, thank you so much, and it taught me the value of teamwork and of being really methodical but also working together. I guess CNN was really like baptism by fire, because you have a live show every day. So I was between Christiane Amanpour's show and Becky Anderson. You had to learn everything. It was back in the day of DVD burning, so I had to learn how to burn DVDs and a lot of internal kind of software, and yeah,
skills just that you will never need again, probably.
Yeah, but you really, if you're the intern, you want to be the one who knows everything so that people can count on you for, you know, stuff they basically don't want to do. Yeah, again, I think it was the value of teamwork and learning from people who are more experienced than you, like watching people who they're making big decisions every day about what to put on air, and to watch that process as it happens is very interesting and taught me a lot. And then I went to Vice, which I worked there nearly 2 years, and that was a totally different experience. So I basically was the staff writer for Vice News, the only staff writer in London. And basically my job was to cover the entire world except for America. So
Easy peasy.
Yeah. So every day it would be like, what's the biggest news story? Sally can write about that. And so I gained sources all over the world, and it was kind of a bit high pressure because, you know, I hadn't done stuff like that. I had to really fight at the beginning to be able to go out and do things. And I ended up covering, you know, I went to Calais. That was when I first started covering migration stories. I covered the Litvinenko inquiry. That was about Russian poisoning in London. And I covered Barack Obama's visit to London, which, like, I'll never forget, because it was me who was, you know, a very disheveled kind of, I don't know what I was then, 25 maybe. And then the Guardian political editor, the Telegraph political editor, you know, all this row of very prestigious political editors, and me just being like, hello.
What a great experience, though.
It was great. And I met so many amazing, passionate people there. And that was fantastic. I don't have regrets about it. But then we all got laid off in 2016, or a lot of us did, which I think is kind of a journalism rite of passage at
this
point.
Yeah, well, it is now. Sadly. It is now. What happened then after 2016? What did you do?
I've been technically freelance since 2016, but on a contract with the Irish Times since 2021. You know, I had to learn to pitch because I hadn't pitched in 2 years, and Yeah, just started pitching places and getting work. I worked for RTE a bit, worked for the Irish Times, who have been so good to me, I have to say, throughout my career. And I was based in London till 2019. And in 2019, I said, I was thinking about moving to Uganda. And I said, if I move to Uganda, can I do Africa coverage? And they said, yeah, okay. So I moved to Uganda, then to Sierra Leone, I think in 2021. And then, yeah, to Beirut in January 2024.
Do you get scared?
Sometimes, yeah.
How do you deal with that? Does fear ever stop you from doing your work?
I wouldn't say it stops me, but I think that you're constantly doing assessments. And yeah, again, if someone was thinking about getting into journalism, I mean, I'm really not like pro, you know, just launch yourself into dangerous situations. I think for me, it took me a long time to build up, you know, to figure out, like I said, like I like going places and spending a long time, you know, you get a lay of the land before you kind of push the boundaries. And I wouldn't advise that anyone just turns up somewhere and launches themselves into anything. You know, I've done a lot of security training. I'm, like I said, very well connected now with lots of people who do similar work. I mean, in Lebanon, we all have WhatsApp groups, in Syria as well, where everybody will share updates if there's anything people need to know about.
So if you're taking risk, is a calculated risk?
It's a calculated risk, but of course, I mean, you can never be 100%. And I did recently, it was actually my first Instagram video I've ever made for the Irish Times. I was going to report in a city called Nabatea in Lebanon. So you're making a calculated risk. We thought it was important to go. We wanted to report there were Israeli attacks ongoing. The city had kind of been made into a no-go zone, but there are paramedics who were staying there and hospital, still functioning hospitals. I've reported a lot on the situation for medics in Lebanon and also attacks on medics. And I wanted to go and interview them and just show what was happening. And we got there. We were, you know, it's kind of a dangerous journey, but we made it and we had all our permissions and had taken various security kind of things that you hope will help, but you don't necessarily know. And we got there and then the airstrike started all around us and we were with the paramedics who were responding to them. So again, it's not like I'm the brave one here. You know, you have medics who know that medics have been targeted, who are like, you know, running towards an airstrike site to see, can they rescue somebody?
These are the double tap and triple tap attacks that I've heard about where one site is attacked once, and then when the medics arrived, it's attacked again, and sometimes again.
Yeah, exactly. In some cases, yeah, triple, even quadruple strikes have been documented. And we were there and we were just waiting. You know, the airstrikes continue. There's an Israeli drone above us. We even saw someone pass by on a motorbike and then they got killed by a drone attack. And in that case, I would say I was scared. I mean, yeah, you're just doing an assessment all the time. So it's like, should we wait? Should we leave? We decided to wait. And then in the end, we went in a convoy with another car of journalists. So we were hoping, you know, all our cars are marked. We were hoping that that would make us be a bit more protected. You don't necessarily know. And we know that there have been many attacks on journalists, but we were hoping. But I would say in that moment, I was a bit scared. But I also think it was valuable and important to report on.
People will know, though, listening to this, Sally, about the physiological response, you know, that you have to danger where your heart starts racing, your breathing speeds up and you have that fight or flight. Do you still get that in those situations or have you learned to control those reactions?
Yeah, I'd say I've generally learned to control them. I mean, I think you're conscious of them. So I think, you know, if you're acting in a slightly erratic way or you feel like you can't make decisions well, like to kind of take a breather. You know, I was talking to a medical emergency surgeon actually the other day who works in one of the hospitals that I'm talking about in, you know, an area that is very dangerous. And he was saying he very deliberately like slows everything down when he's treating someone. So he has to know that he can make a mistake if he moves too quickly in that environment. He could make a mistake that could cost them their life potentially. So even if it's an emergency, he'll try and just slow
the breathing down and have everything just step back a pace.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Is it the career that you imagined for yourself? Is it what you thought you would end up doing, what you're doing right now?
No, I'm not really the greatest at kind of forward projections. So I wouldn't say that I made a major plan. I think particularly the things that I've covered, a lot of it has come about, I'm not going to say totally through chance, but by talking to people and by finding out things. You know, my first book, My Fourth Time We Drowned, it was based on messages that I started receiving from refugees in Libyan detention centers, and they contacted me, and then I started responding, and basically that set me on, you know, years of reporting that became that book, but also became, you know, it was just a massive investigation collection of evidence about effectively crimes against humanity at European borders. Yeah, this new book, I had the idea actually in 2018. So it's been 8 years in the making, but it's kind of a collection of a type of love stories that I've found from different countries that I've reported in or new countries that I went to just for the book, which includes Ukraine and Japan and Iraq. But I think that with journalism, I mean, I don't know how it works for everybody else, but for me, it's always been, you know, I kind of follow what I'm interested in. And when I started out, for example, I remember being told, you know, you can't write and take photos. You have to pick one or the other. And I just kind of carried on doing both. And now both get published.
But I think that's an old fashioned idea, isn't it? That you can't do both, you know, or that old fashioned idea that you can't do audio and visual when it comes to radio and TV. You can do everything now. I mean, it's all one, really.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really film. I can do phone filming, but I haven't learned to edit. I can audio edit. I can do radio to a certain extent, like not as good as you.
And obviously print, you know, writing, which is your thing.
And I think there's different formats that work in different moments. Like, I think that I've appreciated writing these two books because I think that a lot of journalism, and, you know, when I criticize journalism, I do it as a journalist who's, you know, who believes in journalism, but is aware of some of the limitations. I think that books give you a chance to step back and actually kind of examine more systems and structures and even the words that you use and the way that, you know, certain things are prioritized or how power works or all these different ideas that, you know, when you're writing a news article and you need to get in all your basic facts, you don't.
You can't do that. What you can do in the book, right?
Yeah. And so I've really, like, I think that working on these two books, it's meant a lot for me myself to be able to process some of the things I've seen and to be able to think about them and to question myself how I work as a journalist and make sure that I remain self-reflective in that, because I think it's important to stay self-reflective as well.
And how do you manage yourself and how you feel in these really difficult situations?
Of course, you know, when you're talking about a serious situation, you have to speak about the terrible things that you've witnessed and the terrible things you've seen. There are good communities. Like, I have a good community around me and I work with great people. And, you know, I have good friends that, you know, in Beirut and elsewhere. And like the kind of good thing, I guess, about being a freelancer for so many years is there's networks of freelancers, like pretty much anywhere I go in the world now, you know, I'll have some connection or a friend of a friend who's been through this, you know, who's done the same kind of career and understands what it's like. And you can ask for advice or you can meet up, or often they'll offer you accommodation. I do the same now for people in Beirut. And I think that having those networks is really valuable and being able to speak to people about things. I think Lebanon specifically, I really didn't anticipate that this was going to happen. And it has been a process of learning in terms of my own ability to cope with that. And I think that you do notice, and like we talk about it quite openly there, you know, how people's moods can be affected. And like I said, you know, 3 days of a drone is my personal limit. And you can start to get quite angry, I would say, or start to get quite agitated. And I do believe that, like, you shouldn't be interviewing vulnerable people, for example, if it's affecting you like this, because you don't want to be putting your things onto other people when they're in a very, you know, difficult situation.
And do you feel you can maintain balance when you're living in the middle of something rather than somebody who's coming in to look at this situation and observe?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say balance. And I would say that, like, it was very hard. For example, when the war escalated again in March, there was really this feeling of, like, here we go again. Like, I can't believe that this is happening again. for example, during 2024, there was a temporary cemetery. So people, when they can't like bury someone who's died, you know, in their own home village or town because it's not safe, they would bury them in a temporary cemetery. And there was one in the city of Tyre in the south, and I had covered it in the last war. And then when the ceasefire happened, we went there and, you know, people were going to collect their loved ones. And it was kind of a sign of the ceasefire and the war. At that point, everybody hoped ending. And then I remember being back in Tyre in March and seeing it then starting to be filled again. And that was like really, you know, one of those moments where you go, oh, like, I can't believe that this is happening again. And it's just devastating. And at the same stage, yeah, I think that it's important to cover it. So I wouldn't say that you can necessarily find balance. You can find a type of balance, but it's
but you're very difficult. you're very in the story, aren't you, when that is your home?
Yeah, but not, I like, I have to say, you know, I'm a foreigner, I'm privileged, I can leave. There's people who can't leave, you know. And so I would
that is the point of difference, actually, isn't it? And it's a very big point of difference.
It's a very big one.
You can pack your suitcase and you always have that in the back of your mind, do you, that I can go?
Yeah, I would say that, like, I would never say that I'm experiencing it in the same way as somebody whose entire family is there and, you know, who maybe can't get a visa or doesn't have the money that it would take to leave. But I'm witnessing people who I'm close to who that is the case, and that's very difficult. But I obviously, I mean, I'm here right now, so yeah, I can leave if I want to.
Something you said that really struck me, because I've thought about this myself in my own work, whether in talking to you, somebody who's been through trauma, whether that might actually make the situation worse for them, you know, might make it harder for them. And sometimes I think that those people are talking to you because they believe that you in some way can help them. And often you can't, as much as you might want to. That, in the desperate situations where you're operating in, must be just a really heavy burden to carry, is it?
Yeah, I worry about that a lot. And I try to be clear with people. This is my role. I'm a journalist. This is where I'm working. Like, if people ask, is it going to make any difference? You know, I'll say, of course, by raising awareness of it, we hope change will come, maybe, but we have no capacity to ensure that. I mean, I have had like changes happen, I would say, more on a smaller level than a bigger level. But, you know, I've had people who I write about, somebody's got in touch and been like, I want to send them money, or, you know, I want to support their children's education. Or when I lived in Uganda, this used to happen a lot. I'd write about child labor and somebody would say, let me help that family. And, you know, I'm always astounded when that happens. And I just think, you know, this incredible generosity that you can make that connection with somebody so far away through one of my stories. And I think that my reporting, it has also played some role. I wouldn't say it's tricky to quantify, but like, it has played some role in accountability, in terms of like, my first book, for example, was cited in a submission to the International Criminal Court. And, you know, I've had my work as well, my reporting was cited when there was the Rwanda deportation scheme in the UK. It was cited in a legal challenge to the British government. And, you know, it's been used in various cases as well, in terms of like refugee rights and people claiming asylum, various things like that. But of course, yeah, you can never guarantee that those things will happen. And of course, I worry that, you know, the negative ramifications outweigh the positive. And it's really a tricky one. And
I
think
it's a duty of care thing, isn't it? You know, because sometimes you'll be speaking to bereaved people and they just want that family member back. And, you know, clearly there's nothing you can do in that situation. But often you feel like you're shouting into the dark a little bit. You know, what difference is this going to make? And all you want with all of your heart is for them telling you their story to make a difference. And I know you've cited examples there where, you know, things have happened, but in many situations, I'm sure nothing changes, right?
And yeah, you do worry that you're compounding trauma and getting people to talk about terrible things. And it's always a very difficult thing. I try not to, like, I'm not really of the persuasion of convincing people to talk to me. Like, if somebody says they don't want to talk to me, I say, okay, no problem.
Yeah.
Like, that's totally fine, you know. A lot of people do want to talk. And even if somebody's just died, or if somebody's, you know, they've been through a tragedy, they actually want the name to be remembered, or they want people to know what happened. publish these photos of my loved one, you know, tell people that this is what they were like. They see a value in it. And I think that also you kind of have to, you know, honor that in a way. If a family member really wants this to be covered, then yeah.
You have a duty almost to do that. You wrote recently, I needed to remember that there is goodness in the world. Were you really speaking personally there? Are there times when you are almost tempted to forget, or that you're inclined to forget that there is goodness in the world?
Yeah, of course. So people keep asking me, you know, who am I writing for when I write books, for example. Like this book, this is also a love story. I kind of just wrote it for myself, not just for myself, but that, like, who am I speaking to when I write? I'm talking to myself because it's a way for me to gather information and to process my thoughts, also to gather the experiences of other people. I think that a lot of the people who spoke to me for this book, so a lot of the people who I met, they actually really wanted to share their experiences because they felt like they had learned something or they had gathered information that maybe would be useful for other people. Even if they're going through something slightly different, there's still similarities, you know, regarding grief and pain and corruption or war or whatever it may be. And people can feel very alone in these moments. And actually, I think making those connections and reaching out to people, that can mean something. And I think that for me, I focused on love specifically, but it's not just romantic love, it's love for family members, love for community. And I also define it as love for humanity, like just doing good things for other humans, because I see that every day. And when I'm reporting, I do see that every day. But often kind of the journalistic view, which again, I'm not necessarily criticizing because I understand why we have to do it, but it's to focus on just the bad thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like what gets lost is how much love there is and how much care and goodness. And even in me, the way that I think about things, because I shape things through my words. Like when I write something, that helps me to process it in a way to understand what I've seen or what I've heard. I think that for me, it was getting lost that love is there and that goodness and generosity is there. And yeah, hopefully other people are also, maybe they see it already, but I think that a lot of people, they don't see it.
Yeah. Well, I suppose we're a product of our experiences, you know, and what you have seen, maybe there are moments when you forget that is still there, that it is the foundation of all of us, right? Those connections and that love that we have. And also the fact, and I think you show us this through your writing, is that we are more alike than different, aren't we? No matter where we are in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, it's interesting. So the book just came out pretty recently. So I don't know how many people have read it, but some people have told me, you know, there's been moments when they've kind of, you know, almost laughed with recognition over some of the things that people said, even if the person was living, you know, thousands of kilometers away and had a totally different life experience. Yeah, that there's a reminder that there is a lot that brings us all together and that unites us. And I think, yeah, it's also about empathy, isn't it? Like that's, the book opens with a quote from Elon Musk, which I'm going to get wrong now, but it's, empathy is the enemy of Western civilization.
Yes.
I think that empathy at the moment, it feels a bit like empathy is under attack. And actually part of what we try to do as writers, you know, I would say both nonfiction and fiction writers, is to help people have that empathy and yeah, understand that humans are more alike than they are different.
Mm-hmm. And you talk a lot about family. You know, there's all sorts of family relationships throughout this. And in all of your writing, parents and children, grandparents and chosen family as well, communities. Has your reporting from these conflict zones, has it impacted your perception of family or your perception of the importance of family?
I think when you're younger, I think you think that a family is something that you're the chance of what you're born into and who you're born to. And I mean, I'm lucky that I have like a big and amazing family. But yeah, I think that as you grow older, and it was interesting for me actually, because the Rwanda chapter is about, it's probably the most about family in terms of, it's about genocide survivors who were very young when the genocide happened, creating these artificial families. It's a story or a, you know, a situation that I came across in 2014 when I was just beginning to be a journalist. And I actually followed it up in 2024, 10 years later. That was the 30th anniversary of the genocide. I think I could see my own understanding of what a family is and of these kind of community networks develop as well. Because when I first did the story, I didn't really have any concept that people also can choose their families. Whereas when I followed up with people 10 years later, you know, I found many had got married and had children and they now had their own kind of almost chosen family. But at the same stage, I think you can find networks and supports and create families as mm-hmm. you go. But I think also the ties that I see people, obviously not everybody, but the ties that many people have to their family members, it's extraordinary to see the things that people do for each other in a crisis.
Yeah, one of your pieces from the Irish Times, you talk about that gorgeous love story between the relationship between your own grandparents, which almost brought me to tears. It's beautiful. I mean, they had a gorgeous relationship. Why was it important for you to tell that story about them?
So I actually originally had a different title for the book, which was a quote from my granddad talking about my granny. And in the last few years, three of my grandparents have died. So my first granddad to die died when I was about 14. But then in the last few years, I've lost the other three. And both of my grandparents, you know, on both sides had very, very long relationships, which were, I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't know the personal details between them, but like, you know, they were together for decades and you kind of take that for granted when you're young. And then when you get older, you're like, wow, that's actually very extraordinary. I mean, I'm lucky to be surrounded by love, I guess, or to have witnessed love in my life. And I mean, I needed to find a title very fast for various reasons. And this, what he had said about my granny, like, I just thought it was very beautiful. He loved Facebook. So it was something he wrote on Facebook. I think it was their 55th wedding anniversary. Part of it was, I loved you then and still love you now. I mean, that kind of stuck with me. Mm-hmm.
Did they pass or die when you were away? Any of your grandparents?
So my granny on my mom's side, she died when I was in Sednaya prison, which was quite, I don't know if bizarre is the right word, but it was a very, I mean, it was devastating. Yeah. It was a strange, because basically I knew the Syrian regime was going to fall, where we kind of pretty much knew it was going to. And I also knew that she was, I mean, she was in her 90s, but we had kind of been given a warning that she was likely to die soon. And I had to make the decision, do I go into Syria or do I go home? And, you know, I spoke to my family and they were like, listen, just go to Syria. And she was always like, so when I met her, she'd be like, so proud of me. She'd be like, where are you going next? What are you doing? You know, telling everyone that I'm famous and that I write for the Irish Times. And, you know, my family, they were just like, just go. And so when I was in Syria, she died. And that was very sad. And I was obviously devastated to miss the funeral. And it was a very strange environment to be in as that was happening. I just kind of had to ignore it.
Did you have to delay your grieving process, did you feel?
Yeah, it was a very strange because the regime had just fallen. And so we ended up joining. We drove into Syria. It was like inaccessible before that for international journalists. And I ended up joining thousands of Syrians who were going to Sednaya prison, which was a very infamous prison, searching for missing loved ones. And in the book, you know, I already had a chapter of the book that was about Syrians who were missing loved ones and their quest for justice. And I had spent time with women who were searching for children and husbands and fathers. And then when the regime fell, I was like, the chapter got a whole new ending because it was like, suddenly maybe they can get answers. And then it turned out that many people didn't get answers. But it was when I was in Sednaya that my granny died. And I just had this feeling of like, I can never compare my pain to what the people there were going through. But yeah, I mean, I guess grief also is something that unites us all as humans. Mm-hmm. We all experience
that. But I would
that.
Imagine in those types of situations, Sally, that the pull to home is really strong. Or is it? I think I would just want to go home.
I did go home after, like I stayed in Syria, I think a week in total, and then I went back to Ireland. So I already knew I was coming back because it was just before Christmas. So I didn't delay that long, yeah. But it was just a bit confusing because in Syria, we didn't really know what was happening. It was a very chaotic situation. And, you know, I didn't even know I'd have internet. And so, you know, I didn't know if I go in, can I get out again? It was just very uncertain. So I did know that I was going to be home in about a week or so. But at that moment, I had to make a decision. Do I go in or do I go back to Ireland? Mm-hmm. And yeah, with my family's blessing, I went.
So do you feel now that Beirut is home?
I mean, it's at home. the word home can be a bit loaded, can't it? I feel like I'm comfortable in a lot of places and I don't know where I'll be in the long term. Like I said, I'm not the greatest at thinking long term, but right now, Beirut is a lovely city, but what it's gone through and what it's going through is really horrific. It feels strange to say you love Beirut when you also know what's happening, but generally it is a nice place and I think it's important to report on what's happening there.
And after the years that you've worked now in this area, do you feel like you worked out what makes a good foreign correspondent?
No, I haven't. I think that I'm always trying to better my work and improve my understanding of situations. I do think that there's a role for international correspondents. You know, from my work, it's a lot of it has been tracing links between countries and like showing this is like with migration, for example, it never involves just one country, you know, it involves a lot of countries and also showing, you know, the relationship between countries in the West and countries elsewhere or, you know, global inequality as well. It's never just about one country. You have to kind of stay self-reflective, stay humble, be willing to learn from people all the time, be willing to have your own preconceptions challenged and be willing to like assess, you know, are you actually adding value or are you doing more harm than good?
Mm-hmm. Now, because this is Never Have I Ever, I mean, you've done really extraordinary things. Is there anything, though, that you want to do that's on your list of places to see or things to do? What's your Never Have I Ever? Do you have one?
Yeah, I was thinking this because your producer sent me this question in advance very kindly. I don't know. I'm sure I have other hopes and dreams, but I thought of three countries I haven't been to that I'd like to go to: India, Thailand, and Turkey. I've never been to any of those countries.
I think people would be surprised to hear that.
Well, I've been to Istanbul, like the airport, but I don't think that counts. And I also, the other day I tried to write fiction, which I got to 500 words. I'm not sure that it was very good. I don't necessarily think that I can be a novelist, but I did find it interesting in terms of an experiment.
It's like a completely different discipline, right? Writing fiction, when you're so used to writing what you write.
Yeah, it's very hard to have an imagination when you're used to doing journalism. As you probably know, it's like you're so trained to be so every single word you write, you're like, is that right? So I don't know that it's going to get very far, but I do think that it's a good kind of exercise because like John le Carré, for example, didn't he do like a lot of nonfiction research and then turn it into fiction? Because a lot of what he published maybe legally wouldn't have been, he couldn't necessarily have got away with it.
So you probably have an arsenal of all of those facts as well that would be useful for fiction or might be a way to use those facts, right?
Maybe in the future, yeah. But right now, no, I think the 500 words is probably as far as I'm going to get. But I think it would be an interesting exercise at some point when I have time.
Well, Sally, thank you so much for being with us. And congratulations on This Is Also a Love Story, which is published by Fourth Estate. Thank you so much for being with us on Never Have I Ever.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Never Have I Ever with me, Claire Byrne. The producer is Tom Donnelly. And don't forget, you'll find The Claire Byrne Show every weekday morning from 9, live on News Talk Radio and streaming on the Go Loud app.
Never Have I Ever with Claire Byrne, a News Talk original podcast.
Sponsored by O'Brien's Wine. Pour your heart out.